Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and around the world. Well, I'm just back from 2 weeks holiday and I want to thank Joe Lynham and Emmett Oliver for standing in for me. And while I was away, we got new radio listenership figures and it seems that we've got 12,000 new listeners. So I want to welcome each and every one of you. And also, very importantly, I want to thank our now 69,000 strong audience for tuning in every week. We're absolutely delighted with those figures. And I just want to point out, we do love hearing from you at Taking Stock. So, and we read everything and we take your suggestions very seriously. So if you want to get in contact with us, it's takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, coming up on today's programme, Caroline Vakil of The Hill in Washington was at the US Democratic Conference this week. And later in the programme, she'll be joining me to discuss the key moments from that political jamboree in Chicago. And major upheavals at Starbucks with high profile sackings making the headlines. What does it mean for you, the customer? Well, Amelia Lucas of CNBC is going to talk us through the recent goings on. And later, we'll be reflecting on the life and legacy of Mick Lynch, the British tech mogul, often compared to Bill Gates. He tragically died at sea this week. Katie Strict is the senior editor and feature writer at the Evening Standard, and she'll be joining us later to look at his groundbreaking career and the lasting impact that he has left on the UK tech industry. As I said, you can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com, and we're also open on Twitter at StockNT. So let's start with where you might get your cup of joe every day, because Starbucks has been in the news of late for unceremoniously replacing its CEO, and many of its customers around the world are also starting to deal with some of the problems at the counter as a result of some of the changes that are being made at the top. Well, joining me now to discuss what's been happening at Starbucks is Amelia Lucas of CNBC. Amelia, thank you so much for being with us here on News Talk today.
Thank you for having me, Mandy.
Now, before we get into those boardroom dramas, and there have been many of late, Starbucks is a global chain. I don't know if you know, Amelia, but here in Ireland, we've gone a little bit mental about coffee. You know, we're one of the biggest partakers of coffee per capita in the world now. So I want to talk really about some of the problems that some Starbucks customers in the US in particular are dealing with at the moment. What's been happening?
Yeah, so this has been kind of an ongoing issue, I'd say, over the last couple of years. The pandemic really exacerbated it. But, you know, here in New York, it's really common where you walk into a Starbucks cafe and it's kind of chaotic. There's, you know, customers waiting for their coffees that they ordered in person. But when you look at the counter, it's all these mobile orders whose, you know, their rightful owners haven't picked them up yet. And then the baristas behind the counter are totally overwhelmed and they're trying to deal with it all. But it's obviously, you know, it's too much. And the operations in particular seems to have really suffered in the last couple of years, particularly as mobile ordering has become so much more popular here.
Yeah. And that change in the structure of the company that I spoke about at the top, you know, you may be seeing a bit of trickle down effect of the changes that that CEO, who has now been unceremoniously removed, as I said earlier, had been trying to put in place. So what are the changes that he brought in that really haven't been working?
Yeah, so he was in place for about a little under a year and a half. And so he was handpicked by Howard Schultz, who is the former CEO, who's coming back a couple of times to, you know, help the company when it's struggling, when there's, you know, not a clear leadership choice to succeed him. So, you know, Howard Schultz, when he was last in 2022, he had put into place this turnaround plan for Starbucks that meant to tackle some of the bigger issues that had been facing, especially since COVID, where, you know, Starbucks wasn't necessarily at the top of its game anymore. So his handpicked successor, Lakshman Narasimhan, was picked and pretty much followed the strategy that was laid out by Howard Schultz. But the problems became a lot more obvious over the last 6 months, I'd say, where, you know, in the U.S. and elsewhere, the economy has been slowing down. Consumers haven't been spending that much. They're trying to save money. And so for a lot of people, the first thing that they cut back was their Starbucks visits. And so then Starbucks had to figure out, OK, our sales are down. How do we fix this? And it just seemed like the fixes that they put in place weren't, you know, making changes fast enough for the board. And, you know, customers were still dealing with that frustration of, you know, they want a better customer experience. And that's nothing that they really saw from Lakshman's leadership.
No. And when you look at that leadership and the package that Lakshman had as CEO, the numbers are quite extraordinary. I read that his package was worth $28 million. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of money. But I suppose that brings with it an extraordinary amount of responsibility, because the company is a $36 billion per year coffee chain and global. So it, let's get into the boardroom stuff now and what really started to happen and when it started to happen, because the results in April really were the kickoff point for some trouble. Maybe take us through what those results back in April showed.
Yeah, so back in April, Starbucks put out their quarterly results. And first of all, they cut their forecast for the year, which is never a good sign.
No. But
then they also reported a surprise decline in same-store sales, which is a metric that the restaurant industry uses to kind of track sales for restaurants that have been open at least 12 months. That way, you know, you're not accounting for a lot of restaurant openings or closures.
Mm.
And so that really took investors off guard. And, you know, they wanted to obviously make sure that Starbucks was going to fix the issues that were at hand. But also, we've seen two activist investors take stakes in Starbucks since that report in April. One, Elliott Management, is pretty well known for trying to push for changes. And they were looking for changes that would specifically lift Starbucks' stock price, right? Because that's what they care about most as investors. And so we heard from the now former chair of Starbucks board, Melody Hobson, when they announced this most recent CEO change, that they started thinking about a leadership change a couple months ago, which sounds like it pretty much lines up with after that disastrous quarter and the reaction to it. We saw, you know, mentioning Howard Schultz again, he posted on his LinkedIn an open letter, you know, kind of talking about the issues that Starbucks had been struggling with. And he specifically pointed to that customer experience that's been lacking. And he gave some advice for leadership. And I think, you know, generally when there's an open letter posted to you by the former CEO, that's not a great sign that your job is that secure.
No, it's not. So there was plenty of moves afoot behind the scenes, really, at that time, approaching a new CEO, maybe somebody that they couldn't get previously. Maybe take us through what was happening behind the scenes at a kind of board recruitment level.
Yeah. So Melody Hobson has said that she reached out through, you know, an intermediary to Brian Nichol, who is CEO of Chipotle. And I don't know if you guys have Chipotle in
now,
Ireland.
This is, I'm very glad you said that, because it's largely an American thing. So you maybe explain to us how important that is in America and how that's structured, and even the online-ness of that company, because that might explain a lot as to why he's taking up this position.
Yes. I mean, when his appointment was announced, you know, all the analysts, all the investors were so excited for Starbucks specifically, because Chipotle is one of those success stories in the American restaurant business right now. It's a fast casual chain. They make burritos and burrito bowls. It's a very simple operation. You walk into the store, you know, walk kind of down an assembly line, picking out what you want and telling the employee as they assemble it in front of your eyes. But he stepped in 2018, right when Chipotle was dealing with some, you know, incidents around foodborne illness. You know, there was an E. coli outbreak at a couple of its restaurants that really worried investors and worried customers and was really hurting their sales. And Brian came in and he kind of helped turn around the brand. And, you know, he really helped with new menu innovation, which is something that they hadn't really worked on. You know, new menu items was huge. Getting the brand back into shape and making it somewhere that customers actually wanted to go to eat instead of being scared that they might get sick. And then the other big thing is, you know, investing a lot in their digital business. So this has been something that had been in place already, but, you know, they took steps even before digital was that big of a part of their business. It was about 10% of their sales at the time, I think. To make sure that there's a second assembly line just for digital orders. So that way the employees aren't getting caught up trying to help the digital customers and the customer who's standing right in front of them. They also added these drive-through lanes, which were specifically just to pick up the digital orders. That way it's not so chaotic on the inside of restaurants, and customers are happy because it's so convenient for them. They don't even have to get outside their car.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we're right back, Amelia, to where we started, because at the end of the day, these type of brands are about the customer experience. You know, Starbucks started off as supposed to be a relaxing place to go, pick up your coffee, sit down, enjoy a book. And it sounds like the changes that are made there have not worked. And you've just talked us through what Brian Nicole has done at Chipotle. And, you know, that's exactly the antidote to the problems it seems that Starbucks are having. But how have the investors, which are the most important part of this from a company of that size's point of view, reacted? Because for all of his experience, the company that he's running now is largely an American one. This is a massive global organization. And he's now on, I think, $100 million package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you just kind of hit the nail on the head, because obviously when this appointment was announced, you know, Wall Street was overjoyed. The stock rose 20%, I believe, the day that the announcement was made. But, you know, some analysts have said, you know, we really believe in Brian. We think he's like the best in class in the industry as a CEO. But if there's going to be any struggles that he's coming up against, it's that Chipotle is a relatively simple business and Starbucks is so much more complex. You know, it's much more of a global business. Chipotle, like you said, is mostly in the US. Chipotle owns most of their locations. Starbucks, you know, owns a lot of its locations, but it also has a lot of licensees, like, you know, the kind of cafes that you see inside airports, or, you know, some of its international markets are also licensees and not owned by the company. And then there's also, you know, the China business, which presents a big problem for Starbucks right now. It's their second largest market and it's really struggling right now. It's dealing with a lot of local competition. And, you know, Brian Nicole doesn't have any experience with the Chinese market. And I think that will be a big question. And we'll see if he's able to deal with the complexity. But he also has this reputation for being really good at hiring people and getting the right executives in place to fix the problems that are, you know, that the company has to deal with.
And what about the unions element of Starbucks? I recall a couple of years ago, they were one of the first big multinationals in America to start down that road of unionization. Will he have had experience in dealing with that?
Yeah, so he doesn't have much experience dealing with unions, and the union negotiations are ongoing right now. So I think it's about 350, 450 locations, I want to say, in the U.S., which are unionized, which is still a relatively small part of its footprint. But it sounds like Starbucks and Workers United are still in talks right now to figure out that first contract. So we'll see what happens with that. But no, Chipotle is not unionized. And so that will also be, you know, another challenge that Brian will have to contend with.
Well, Amelia, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And you've given us an awful lot of insights into what's happening behind closed doors in the boardroom and over the counters in America. You never know. It's coming this way soon for sure. That was Amelia Lucas from CNBC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, tech entrepreneur Mick Lynch tragically died at sea this week. What made him so successful and what was his life's journey like? Well, we'll be taking you through that after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, on Monday of this week, news broke that Mike Lynch, the tech entrepreneur often referred to as the Bill Gates of the UK, was among a number of people missing after a yacht sank off the coast of Sicily. Later this week, we learned of his sad passing. Well, joining me now with more information on the life and legacy of Mike Lynch is Katie Strict, who is the senior editor and feature writer for The Evening Standard. Katie, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Mike Lynch, it's not a name that we knew very well here in Ireland, but we've learned bits and pieces about him over the course of the last week. I just wanted you to take us through his life, where he came from first, and really kind of explore how he became so successful. And let's start here in Ireland. What is his connection and his roots here with Ireland?
Absolutely. So Mike Lynch's childhood was sort of a far cry from the life of yachts and million-pound properties and luxury. I guess he'd become accustomed to before his death this week. So he was born to an Irish immigrant family in Ilford in Essex in the 1970s. His father was a fireman from County Cork, and his mother was a nurse from County Tipperary in Ireland. He won a scholarship in London to Banford School, in which is a private day school in northeast London, at the age of 11. And then he went on to read natural sciences at Cambridge. And that is where his fascination with technology really began. So he completed a doctorate and gained a research fellowship in adaptive pattern recognition. And that was all before he set up Cambridge Neurodynamics, which was a tech firm specializing in fingerprint recognition for the police. And that's back in 1991.
Mm. And, you know, obviously extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily gifted. And as you say, his origin story is a far cry from yachts off the coast of the Mediterranean. But he took that talent and he used it to its utmost, I suppose, potential when he co-founded a software company. Can you talk us through that company, Autonomy, and why it was so successful and what it actually did?
Absolutely. So as you explained, it was a software and data analysis company, Autonomy, and it went on to become one of the UK's most successful startups. And that was what really led to Lynch being called the UK's first tech billionaire. So he was awarded an OBE for services to enterprise in 2006 and was appointed to the board of the BBC that same year. 5 years later, so by 2011, he'd been elected onto the then Prime Minister David Cameron's Council for Science and Technology, advising the then Prime Minister on the opportunities and risk of development for AI, which is obviously now so prolific across society. He also founded was a founding investor in the FTSE 100 cybersecurity firm Darktrace. Mm. Many of your listeners may have heard of. And he also set up the venture capital company Invoke Capital. So I think, it was this sort of this career altogether that earned him that nickname of Britain's Bill Gates.
And what was his wealth? Like, how much money was this man worth?
So by the time of his death this week, he was estimated to be worth £852 million. So one of the UK's richest men. Mm. And as we mentioned, you know, his life had become you know, one of great luxury, and you know, a real symbol of that, I think, was his super yacht, his sailboat, the Bayesian, which I think was just seen as the culmination of decades of hard work, really. It was built in 2008, and he'd named it after the branch of statistics he'd made the subject of his Cambridge PhD. And, you know, typically he would spend his summers sailing around the Mediterranean and Caribbean.
Mm.
And I think he really spoke of it with pride. You know, quite a few of his current and former staff members have been interviewed this week for obvious reasons. And one told the Times that he'd had this miniature model of it made, and they had photos of it all across the hallway in his Chelsea home. So it's clearly something he took tremendous pride in.
Yeah. Now, you know, notwithstanding all that success, I mean, he wasn't a household name. He had, you know, obviously the luxury yacht and everything, but he's not somebody who, it seems, as you know, he craved attention or liked living in the public limelight at all.
Absolutely. I mean, he had this house in Chelsea in West London, but I think the majority of his time was spent on the family farm in Suffolk, where they owned six dogs and raised rare breeds of pigs and cows and koi carp. You know, he's spoken in interviews of Suffolk being the place he liked to go and have a long bath and think and make a lot of his big business decisions.
Mm.
I think actually, you know, the reason most people would have heard his name before this week, unfortunately, was to do with this trial, which I'm sure we'll move on to, that sort of ended up dominating a decade of his career, really.
Yes, and this was to do with the sale of that company, Autonomy. Maybe you'll just take us through the premise of the trial itself, because it was to be a very long battle that lasted, I think, over a decade.
Yeah, it was a 12-year legal battle in the end. And so it was all over these fraud and conspiracy charges relating to the sale for £8.6 billion of Autonomy, this company we've spoken about, to the US computer giant Hewlett-Packard. So that sale took place in 2011. And at the time, it was sort of seen as Mike Lynch's crowning glory, and it earned him more than £500 million. So it really was
extraordinary. Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And what was wrong with the sale, according to the powers that be?
So Lynch went on to be fired by Hewlett-Packard, and they went on to accuse him and a few other executives of grossly inflating its size and profits during the sale. This is something Lynch had always, you know, absolutely denied. He maintained his innocence till the end, arguing that basically the company was suffering from buyer's remorse. So he ended up taking the case to the UK High Court, trying to fight his extradition to the US, but he was eventually flown to California and spent 13 months, so the vast majority of 2023, under house arrest before then appearing in a courtroom in San Francisco in March this year, defending himself with this sort of world-beating legal team that he'd hired. He was given just a 0.5% chance of acquittal at the time. And so it is really extraordinary. You know, he faced the prospect of 25 years in a US jail. But he and his former finance executive went on to win the case and were acquitted in June this year. So all very recent.
Yeah, and the awful tragedy of this week's events are this was his second start, if you like. He really saw this as the end of one chapter, the beginning of another. I read a quote that he said in relation to the court case, and you know, it's, he said, he told reporters that he believed he only got justice because he was rich. Quote, "You shouldn't need to have funds to protect yourself as a British citizen." You know, he said, "The reason I'm sitting here, let's be honest, is not only because I was innocent, but because I had enough money not to be swept away by a process that's set up to sweep you away." And this trip was his new start.
Exactly that. He had literally spoken of this second life that he wanted to live after he was acquitted in June. So it just is this really striking and extraordinary story, the fact that he had spoken of this elation, spoken of the second life, particularly with his family. And, you know, so many of the details of this story are just so extraordinary. One being that the cruise that he was on at the time of the sinking was supposed to be a celebration. It was him taking his family, his legal team, you know, many of his colleagues and former colleagues out for this celebratory trip around the islands off Sicily. And so the thought that it ended in such tragedy is unbelievably sad. And, you know, he'd sort of spoken of going off to America, where he was under house arrest, and having to say goodbye to everything and everyone, because he really didn't know if he'd be ever coming back at that point. Mm. And he had various health issues, and I think he'd been convinced that if he had indeed gone to jail, he wouldn't have made it out alive. And the thought that he did, I mean, he had those 2 months, but he only did have those 2 months.
And there's some other extraordinary coincidences around this tragic accident, isn't there?
There is a really cruel twist to this story, and it was sort of unbelievable. I think it was one of those moments when you read a news story and you have to sort of reread it and think, surely this is just you know, unbelievable, really. The former finance executive, Stephen Chamberlain, who was acquitted alongside Lynch, that we mentioned earlier in this fraud trial, he too lost his life on Monday, it turns out, in a completely separate incident. He was fatally struck by a car while he was out running near his home in Cambridgeshire. And just the you know, the two incidents are clearly not connected, but the timing certainly adds this quite chilling layer to what is already just a really shocking tale.
And what do you think, Katie, his legacy will be in the tech industry in the UK?
I think, I mean, his legacy, you know, so much of what he has helped to shape has had to do with artificial intelligence, which is now so prolific and mainstream here in the UK. And we could not have said that 5-10 years ago. You know, autonomy was one of the big success stories in Britain. And, you know, he was one of the UK's richest men. And I think he stood out as being, yes, as you mentioned earlier, not someone who particularly loved the limelight, but just loved the technology, the maths, the statistics. You know, he really, really loved the nitty gritty of the job.
Yeah, and the fact that he had named that yacht after the PhD that he had completed was, I suppose, a testimony to how much he loved his craft, obviously.
Quite, exactly. And loved his craft, loved his family. And, you know, two of his family were with him, and his daughter, Hannah, the youngest, who had just finished school in London, is still missing. So, yeah, we are obviously thinking of the family there.
And then the final person that I wanted just to touch on, who also was tragically involved in this accident, was Jonathan Bloomer, of course, the chairman of Morgan Stanley International. So showed you the type of people who he had around him to celebrate or start this next phase of his life.
Absolutely, yeah. There was Jonathan Bloomer, who you've just mentioned. There was Ayla Ronald, who was a Clifford Chance lawyer, who was on the team that helped to secure Lynch's acquittal. One story that I know has done the rounds this week, and for obvious reasons, is that of Charlotte Galunsky, who was one of the partners at Invoke Capital. She was there on the cruise with her husband, James, and their daughter, Sophia, who was just 1 year old. And she has spoken quite widely now to the media this week about this sort of terrifying moment that she found herself holding her daughter in the air, in the dark, in the water, after being separated from her husband in the water. And she sort of said that for 2 seconds she thought she'd lost that baby in the sea. And amazingly, she and her husband and her baby have all survived and were rescued. But it does, you know, her quotes really speak to the horror of events that took place there that night.
Absolutely. Unimaginable events, and horror, as you say, is the only way to describe it. Katie, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today and to take us through the life and legacy of Mike Lynch. That was Katie Strict, Senior Editor and Feature Writer at the Evening Standard. Thank you.
Thanks, Vandy.
This is Taking Stock here on News Talk after the break. This week, it was all about Kamala Harris, and many celebrities and famous Democratic faces from the past came together in Chicago to support her. Caroline Vakil from The Hill in Washington was there, and she'll be here after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item this week, we're turning stateside because all eyes were on Chicago this week as it hosted the Democratic National Convention. The highlight of the week was the rubber stamping of Vice President Kamala Harris as the party's candidate in November's election. But there were many, many famous appearances by familiar faces from the Democrat Party and also celebrities along the way. Well, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now by Caroline Vakil from The Hill, who was in Chicago this week. Caroline, how are you?
I am doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, I just want to talk to you first of all about the atmosphere and the sentiment around the conference this week. I'm just thinking, a couple of weeks ago, the Democrats had that disastrous debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and I was speaking to someone after, and they were literally, they sounded like they were clinically depressed. What was the atmosphere like going into this early this week?
I think it's been a bit of a, I mean, to say it's a 180 would be a complete understatement. I mean, it feels in a bit like whiplash between the month that we had last month with, you noted President Biden's debate performance, leading Democrats into a real panic mode. And to now you're seeing so much enthusiasm. And, I was speaking to someone from Louisiana who was attending the convention earlier this week, and he made some really interesting comments to me. He said, you can tell when enthusiasm is manufactured. Mm. This is not manufactured enthusiasm. This is genuine.
And is that enthusiasm justified in your mind, or is this just a sugar rush?
That's a really interesting question. I think that this is sort of it was a pressure valve being released. I think that there was so much anxiety among Democrats over what their electoral chances were going to be like with President Biden at the top of the ticket that I think in a lot of ways there's a lot of relief. I think that to your point, the question that remains is how much of the honeymoon that Vice President Harris right now has, how much is that going to last? I do think that there is a sugar rush right now, but I think in a lot of ways, there's also the sense that Democrats are, passing the torch, which they've been pushing for, I think, specifically, progressives and younger members, and seeing the potentially first Black woman and first woman of South Asian descent to be, president, I think is really electrifying for a lot of Democrats.
And just as a journalist attending something like this, I'm interested to know what happens to someone like you? Do you get to attend everything? Do you have to select some events that you want to go to? We have a thing here in Ireland called Ardeshena, which is like a party conference. It's a pretty small affair compared to anything that happens in America. But like, what happens for someone like you who goes to that? Do you attend everything and just exhausted by the end of the week, or are you very selective?
I think the key for me in this being my first convention is to try to be selective about what you attend, because otherwise you'll really run yourself into the ground. I think that, you know, there are no shortage of events. I mean, you've got donors, strategists, candidates, elected officials all in the same place. It's a bit of a homecoming for the party. So you can imagine there's going to be parties at night, but there's also going to be press conferences. Every state has a delegation breakfast, you know, throughout the week. So me and some of my colleagues have attended those. Lawmakers have also, and different congressional caucuses have been meeting with each other. There's definitely time to be, you know, going to the campaign, and they hold a presser every morning. And so there's a lot of different things happening even before the convention begins. And, you know, it's helpful. There's obviously keynote speakers listed on each one, so you can kind of see who's going to be attending those. Obviously, a lot of up and coming rising stars are, you know, headlining some of these events.
Mm. Yeah. And the main reason I asked you about the atmosphere is they're going out now as a party into the election in a kind of unified way, optimistic. So that's why I think, you know, the mood music around these events is very important. But back to what happened. So the main thing before they were able to rubber stamp Vice President Kamala Harris as their candidate, they had to say goodbye to Joe Biden. How do you feel that was handled?
You know, I think that they definitely, you know, were very clearly conscious of that. And that's why I think he was given the prime speaking slot on Monday. And so, you know, look, we saw lawmakers that paid homage to him in their speeches or gave him the nod. I think that was, you know, clearly on display Monday night, even before his speech. So I think that in some ways, what the DNC has been doing is kind of trying to link the past, present, and the future. You know, or I guess maybe the present and the future. You started off with President Biden, the current Democratic, you know, president, passing the torch slowly on to, you know, Vice President Harris. We've been hearing more and more from, you know, speakers who have been touching on Kamala Harris in their remarks. And so, but, you know, while also paying homage to Joe Biden. So, you know, it's that delicate balance of paying homage and giving the nod to the president of the United States while also looking at who's going to be leading the party ticket in November.
Mm. Yeah, because there was a little bit of criticism here early on in the week that, you know, there wasn't enough about Joe Biden and he wasn't thanked enough by others. But I guess it's a sentiment of politics. Everyone's looking at the future, right? But somebody I really respect told me that Bernie Sanders gave an amazing speech. So I went back and watched it. And indeed, like, he laid out the significant achievements that Joe Biden has made over the last number of years. But it's just that it's all about the future, isn't it? And that's what people like the Obamas and Clinton had to do. They had to push forward.
And also, we, you know, addressing the other elephant in the room, I think there's some, you know, conflicted feelings about, you know, being in the same convention, I'm sure, with, you know, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, you know, the Obamas, you know, some of the Democrats that I think have been pushing and have been eager to see a new face, you know, at the top of the ticket. And so I think there's a little bit of that tension in between in terms of how do you delicately balance that.
Mm.
So I think that was also, you know, obviously, kind of consciously on display as well.
Yeah, it's like that awkward family get together Christmas where nobody mentions the dispute that happened halfway through the year.
Exactly.
So what about the other people who spoke there? First of all, I wanted to look at Governor Tim Walz. How do you think he did? Do you think we got to know him? What will he bring? Do you think he's a game changer in those swing states for Kamala Harris?
Listen, I think the face of, you know, the face of his son, Gus Walz,
yeah,
went viral. Him just sobbing, I think, really tells you it all. Just to have his own children who were so moved by his speech. And, you know, his speech was really one of the key highlights last night. I mean, you know, he is someone that I think has tried to kind of come off as being the you know, the sort of the quintessential American dad. You heard, you know, former President Obama earlier this week making fun of his flannels in his closet. And so to see him in this new role where he's, you know, using teleprompters and kind of getting in front of this national audience, I think that Democrats were really excited to see him speaking, and were definitely, you know, it was a very well received speech that he gave.
Yeah, certainly. And the Harris family, turning to Kamala Harris before we look at who spoke about her, just she hasn't gone through that process of intense scrutiny for 18 months the way a candidate normally does. So whilst we're now waiting for her to get into the debates, did we learn more about her, her family, her person? Do you think the American people are at peace now, or feel that they know her a bit more at the end of this week? So this week, was it enough about her, or was it more about people telling you to trust her?
That's a great question. I mean, we did hear a little bit from Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. You know, it'll be interesting to see if we hear from more, you know, sort of closer within her orbit. I believe she also may have had some childhood friends earlier this week who had spoke at the DNC about her. And, you know, we're also going to be waiting to see what kind of interview she's going to be giving to the media ahead of November, since she hasn't sat down for one yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably good advice for her. I know the media hate it, but you know, the more that she can control her own narrative now and between now and the election, the better for her. But let's move back to the other people who spoke at the conference. I wanted to look in particular at the likes of Bill Clinton and Oprah Winfrey making set piece speeches. Again, like the elephant in the room was Trump, and not giving him too much credence, but at least reminding people, those two, the dangers of returning to another Trump presidency. How did that go down?
I think that was a clear theme too. I mean, I'm also sort of reminded of House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, the top Democrat in the House. He kind of likened Donald Trump to being a quote unquote old boyfriend that you just couldn't get rid of. And so I think that they are, I think, you know, it is sort of a delicate balance. I think we heard more about Donald Trump earlier in the week. I think that to that point, though, there is a balance between, you know, giving the party someone to vote for versus against. And I think that speakers are trying to walk that fine line.
Mm. So who else was there? What celebrities did we hear from?
There were musical performances from Stevie Wonder, John Legend, Saturday Night Live comedian Kenan Thompson was there, and kind of poking fun again at Project 2025. I mean, it was a pretty star-studded lineup. And I would also note too, a lot of these rising stars within the Democratic Party, a lot of the Democratic governors from Michigan, Illinois, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, all of them giving pretty primetime speaking slots.
Mm. And those celebrity endorsements, do they matter a great deal in American politics? Because here in Ireland, like, and I worked in politics a long time here, sometimes the endorsements from celebrities, not that we have as many as you, but they can either work against you and they can work against the celebrity. But are they important in the election in the US?
I think that they are. I mean, some of them may not be particularly surprising. And in general, endorsements are not going to necessarily sway a lot of voters. Sometimes it matters a bit more locally if you have a local, you know, or national newspaper whose editorial board will back someone. That might help flip a couple undecided, you know, voters. Mm. In terms of celebrities, these are the kinds of, you know, the people that have been performing or attending the DNC are the same ones that you might expect that would be supporting the Democratic Party ticket. But of course, you know, they have a platform that, you know, elected officials may not. And I think, you know, of course, everyone is sort of speculating, you know, about a potential Beyonce endorsement or a Taylor Swift endorsement. And, you know, obviously what that could mean as well. Yeah. They haven't weighed in, of course, but, you know, sometimes when you have that big of an audience, it certainly doesn't hurt.
No. And for you, out of the political and celebrity speeches that you heard during the week, apart from Kamala Harris herself, who impressed you the most? Who do you think did the most impressive job?
I think Michelle Obama was probably one of the biggest speakers, if not the biggest speaker of the DNC so far. I mean, she led attendees in Do Something chants that really energized the crowd, kind of akin to what we heard of when they go low, we go high. Mm. And very, you know, it was a very moving speech. She and her husband, of course, former President Barack Obama, I think gave some very powerful speeches and really kind of reminded Democrats why they were excited and energized. And so I would say those two were probably some of the biggest movers and shakers in terms of speech makers for Kamala Harris.
Yeah. And the fact that Michelle Obama in particular has remained outside of politics a little, she has a freedom, I think, to speak to delegates and be a bit more robust and direct them in a way that maybe former President Obama can't actually do. Final word before I let you go, Caroline, please. One of the things we heard in the lead up to this was about the protests which might happen around the conference in relation to the Gaza conflict. How did that manifest itself? Was that a large bearing on proceedings?
So in terms, there have been several protests that have been scheduled for this week. One of the bigger ones took place on Monday. There were fewer protesters than anticipated. I think we've seen a bit of a split screen because within the convention, it's sort of like you're so removed from the outside of the city that it feels like while the convention's going on, there are protesters, but they're kind of going side by side and they're not really running into each other that much. You only have 30 uncommitted delegates who have been allowed inside the convention center. Wow. You know, who basically were those who were selected to kind of represent those uncommitted primary voters that cast their ballots earlier in the spring. And so you do have that cohort, but obviously not to the same degree as maybe having protesters outside of the city.
Well, that was Caroline Vakil of The Hill. And now let's end with the words of Kamala Harris.
Joe, I am filled with gratitude. Your record is extraordinary, as history will show, and your character is inspiring. And Doug and I love you and Jill and are forever thankful to you both. On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America. One must ask, why exactly is it that they don't trust women? Well, we trust women. We trust women. And when Congress passes a bill to restore reproductive freedom, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law. President, I will stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests for their time and very valuable insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you've got any comments on today's show, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is up next. Thanks again for tuning in to Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.